And Joel and I also told each other, we're like, what's our strategy going to be finishing up this thing? Because I brought up the dropping out, and I said, I've never dropped out of a race. And he said, I haven't either. And I was like, okay, well, that's going to be our goal. We're going to go until we miss the cutoff time, whatever that may be. And that also was a big mental strategy as well. It's like, okay, well, we're gonna keep going. We're just gonna tough this out and just go until we're pulled.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. I have a returning guest this week. Shannon Mick was here back in episode 63. We talked about her self-supported FKT. Shannon is a licensed therapist and a mindset coach for ultramarathon runners as well as other athletes. Now, you don't have to be an athlete. You don't have to be physically fit to be a mindset performance coach. But I think that it does help to know that that your coach has run through the heat and the sweat and the mud and the dark, has been there and done that, and speaks from experience. When Shannon talks about the mindset to run ultramarathons, she has been through it. She has the experience. We had a great conversation. I hope you enjoy listening in. Here's my conversation with Shannon Mick. Well, welcome back to you, Shannon. I was looking, and your last episode was episode 63, about almost a year ago.
Wow.
So, and I remember last time we talked, you just finished an FKT, I think, one of them. And I know that you have a couple of them. So, tell a little bit. When we last talked, was that your first FKT, or did you? That was the one. I think Hell Creek was the one that we had talked about. When you ran into a cougar in the woods.
Oh, yeah. So that was the most recent one. Yeah,
Okay.
that was what I called to hell and back,
Yeah.
because it started at the old stone house in one park. And then went to Hell's Hollow and at the end of another park. And then I went all the way back to the stone house. And yeah, that's where the cougar was waiting for me, 4 miles from my
From your
finish.
finish. How long was that one?
That took about 16 and a half hours.
Okay, and it was about 50 miles.
It ended up being 52 point something, 53 miles.
Okay, so yeah, for those who may not know, FKT is fastest known time, and it's not necessarily by the distance; it's by the trail, isn't it? You pick. There's a website that you can pick a trail, and you can see who's recorded their fastest time on that particular trail. It could be any distance.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they have requirements though for picking what trails you can do as well. But yeah.
You mean so you have to follow the. I mean, do you have to submit your course off your GPS as well?
Yeah. You have to submit a course, GPX file, photos along the way to prove that you were actually there and did it.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
Yeah, there's a number of rules to follow.
Yeah. Oh, and then you did. Was it self-supported?
Yeah, unsupported.
Unsupported. Okay. So you carried everything with you the entire time. Now, if I remember the rules, the unsupported means you can't even make a phone call to tell people you're okay.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because you don't want to put yourself at risk of being getting help in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. So, and that can't be even random people who maybe driving along and say, here's a water.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to be like, sorry, I can't.
Yeah, because there was somebody else I had talked to who had done an unsupported run, I think on a section of the Appalachian Trail, And he was telling me about the difference between that. And he said, you know, it was something had gone wrong, and he couldn't even call and let his family know, hey, I'm going to be delayed, I'm, you know, because something had happened to some of his gear.
Yeah, it's wild. So,
yeah. Now there is a self-supported option where you can you basically can drop water along the way, or you know, leave supplies. It's just that nobody is there meeting you and giving you stuff at various points.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I always worry about that option because, like, if you're doing a really long trail, like Appalachian Trail or like Baker Trail or something that's over like 100 miles, I would say I'd be worried about getting there and someone stealing my stuff. And then you'd be like, well, crap, my stuff's gone and I needed it.
Especially if you were counting on it for water.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's good. Well, for people who made this maybe their first episode, how was it you decided that you were going to start running?
My husband got me into running back when we started dating in, I think it was around 2010.
So was he a runner before you met?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. He was a marathoner at the time. And then once we were dating, and then I discovered, you know, ultra marathons, and, you know, about the time we were married, I became an ultra marathoner. And a few months later, I talked him into it, and he became an ultra marathoner.
So how long that sounds like it went pretty quickly for you to get from just starting to running ultra marathons. How long was the process?
It took me, because I was brand new to running, you know, it took me a few years to build up, you know, like making the stupid, like new runner mistakes. You know, I had a stress fracture in my foot and like that kind of stuff. So, you know, once I got past the mistakes and, you know, through the learning process, I did so much research on ultra running. I did my first 50 miler, my first ultra in 2016.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So what made you decide? I mean, you said that to hell and back was your second FKT. What made you decide, like, okay, this racing thing is fine, I think I'm going to go do an FKT?
Yeah. So I think just that sense of adventure and the scariness of it, having the really big goal, but also just being out there by yourself is pretty scary. And I knew, like, doing something that was 50-ish miles was going to be pretty daunting for me as far as just being out there alone. Like races, it's so much easier. You know, like a 50-mile race feels so much easier than an unsupported 50-mile just solo run.
Mm-hmm. Well, in races, you have an aid station every 5 miles and, yeah, and other runners out there on the course. and course marking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, that was. And then you also did it at one shot. So you ran, you knew that you'd be running in the dark, at least part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew. I didn't want to be running in the dark, but I did. I packed a headlamp and a spare headlamp just in case. And yeah, I had a few miles left to go in the dark.
Yeah. So was it summertime?
It was, yeah. It was summertime and it was pretty hot out. I made several water stops. I had a Katadyn water filter, and I made several water stops and refilled and literally just dumped water on my head. So good, though.
So you refilled like out of a creek? Or?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So like the first half, there's little streams, you know, that trickle by. But once you get to the second half, which is going to be the middle of your run, because it's out and back, there's a Slippery Rock Creek, and that's pretty substantial. In fact, people can whitewater raft in it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty scenic, and it's a good place to get water. Yeah.
Now, where's the park that you ran at?
It's in Western Pennsylvania.
Western Pennsylvania. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't remember if you lived in Pennsylvania or New Hampshire, and so.
Western Pennsylvania. It's about 40 miles, or no, 40 minutes north of Pittsburgh.
Well, cool. Where did you go then? After you're doing your, you're getting into your 50 miles, where were you? Where did you go after your 50 miles? Did you just keep doing 50s?
I did. I kept doing 50s. It became like a favorite thing. I've done so many more 50 milers than any other race distance. I just like being able to improve, though. You know, I want to find something I'm good at, kind of stick with it for a little bit, because I know if I can improve that, then I should have an easier time doing the higher distances.
So did you, I know you just ran a 100 mile, or you had an attempt at 100 mile. So when did you do your first attempt at doing 100 or going above? Have you done 100K?
I did 100K. It did not go very well. part of that was the race to blame, because they were pretty kind of poorly set up.
Okay.
As far as aid station went, so.
Oh, really? So you got the aid station, you didn't have what you needed?
No, they had like ran out of water, and they like the food was sitting out in the hot sun. So it's like, okay, well, all the M&Ms and stuff were melted, and the bananas had gone bad. Like, and there wasn't even much to choose from anyways to eat. Like, it was just pretty bad. It was pretty bad. And it's like a race that, you know, they try to attract a lot of elite runners.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was kind of like, really? Yeah.
That's odd, because I know a lot of ultramarathon races, typically the aid stations are like buffets.
Yeah.
And, it's odd that they would run out, especially on something like, 100K.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So did you then? I knew you started then going after the 100 mile distances. What was that like for you?
It was extremely hard, because I chose a race just because it was only like about 2 hours up the road, pretty good local race, in a beautiful state park. And so that's Oil Creek 100. And I've attempted it 3 times now and have missed the cutoff time every single time.
So what's the cutoff?
I think it's 32 hours.
32? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know 100 mile races, they tend to be oftentimes 30 hours, sometimes 32. And you can almost kind of judge the difficulty of the course by the cutoff time.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. There was a race in Oklahoma that I think the 100, well, they have a 135 mile option as well. And I think for all of it, the cutoff time is 48 hours. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough course. There's not much. Well, if you're really good, maybe it's runnable, but there's a lot of it that is, it's just, you have to hike because it's either going up or down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oil Creek. So Oil Creek, I don't think that it gets enough, attention as it should, because it's pretty gnarly, as you would read on the race website. It's gnarly, unforgiving, and then the slogan is like, "Do you have what it takes?" Uh-huh. It has about just under 18,000 feet of elevation gain.
18,000.
Yeah.
Yes,
which I believe is more than Western States 100.
Okay. Yeah. That is quite a bit.
Right, yeah.
Well, there are some pretty good elevations. Is that part of the Appalachian Mountains?
No, it's just a little state park called Oil Creek State Park, and the trail is the Girard Hiking Trail. And it's just a loop. You gotta do three loops on it plus a like a, another 7 mile loop and this little 1 mile section at the end of every, you know, big loop.
Huh.
That's, yeah, it's just up and down, up and down, up and down.
Yeah, in the eastern United States, I'm not as familiar with geography as I am of some of the ones out west. But yeah, I know that they've got some hills out there, and yeah, so that sounds like an interesting race. So you say you've done it three times. I know this last time, what was it like?
This last time was so brutal. So I've missed the cutoff time, you know, the three times I have. This year, I didn't even make it as far as my first attempt at it. This year, I missed the cutoff time at 100K.
Okay.
In previous years, I've missed the cutoff time at, like, I think it was mile 76. And then the second attempt was mile 85. Mm-hmm. And then this time was only 100K. Okay. So.
Well, there was a lot of people who missed the cutoff time. Not a lot of people who didn't finish, right?
Right. Yes. It was historic for the race. It's like 26% finishing rate or something really low. Let me see if I have it. I think I pulled it up. So for the 50K. Distance. So there's three race distances. For 50K, there were 196 bib numbers assigned, 170 started, 28 DNF'd. Normally for that race, there's just a handful of DNFs. So that's just one loop. 100K is two loops. So they had 117 bibs assigned, 107 people started, 42 DNF'd. So 39% was a new record. Okay, and here, the 100 mile, 94 had bibs assigned, 84 started, 58 DNF'd, and 26 people finished. So that's a 69% drop rate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the cause of the difficulty for finishing?
It was the weather. Of course. The race is on a Saturday morning. It starts at 5 a.m. So Friday night there were storms that came through, and it just poured and poured and poured, and it was relentless, and it continued into all of Saturday, just, you know, raining. It was raining at the race start, and I think maybe we had 1 or 2 hours without rain for the whole race. It was really brutal.
So you start
and windy. Yeah.
What time of the year was it?
It's in the fall. It's in October.
So it could be. It was not necessarily a warm rain.
No, it was cold. I was actually getting hypothermic during it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Did you wear like a jacket?
I did, yes. I had on an exoskin shirt that's supposed to like keep you at the right temperature. Mm-hmm. And I had a wind jacket, a North Face wind and waterproof jacket over top of that. And I almost didn't go back out for loop two. You know, my friend happened to be at the middle school, Mark. He literally saved me and went to my vehicle and got out clothes that I didn't think I was going to need, but I had, and he brought them back. But still, even with adding layers, I was so cold at night. And that was kind of like when I missed the cutoff time, you know, like, mm-hmm. I came in to after that second loop and I was just so cold again. It was ridiculous.
So did you, was the, I mean, you had a waterproof jacket. Did that keep you dry, or did you, was it one of those things like you sweat enough that you still were wet?
Yeah, I think it was, I sweat enough that I was still wet. It didn't, yeah, it didn't, like, it kept the rain out for the most part, I think, because I had a buff up around my neck and a hat on my head, but it wasn't enough to actually, like, keep me warm. I swear I felt the wind going through my jacket.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have never had to race in the with it, you know, being that kind of wind and rain. I've run in some of that rain before, but I've always chosen not to, just to let myself get wet and try to keep myself moving. But I would imagine, you know, you'd have to have a different strategy in a race.
Yeah.
So what was, what did you have, chafing issues or any other kinds of things? I mean, was it mostly trying to keep warm that was your prop, was your challenge?
Yeah, trying to keep warm and trying to stay motivated to be out there because everything was either a hill or mud or both. Like the mud was almost up to my knees in parts. It was really bad, and people were, you know, hiking off of the trail. So it was like damaging the trail, widening the trail, and all the mud would go into the middle of the trail. And it was just, it was a true mess. And then of course, like the rocks, because it is a very rocky trail in sections, you can't see the rocks and roots under the mud. So it was pretty challenging.
So the water, did the water wash the mud down to the trail then deep enough you couldn't see the rocks? Is that what?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There was water standing in sections of the trail with mud. And then there were sections of just mud. And then there were sections where it's like you're running in a stream.
So what do you do to keep yourself? I mean, you didn't quit. So what were the things that you did to keep yourself going when it got to be that, like that?
Yeah, I just kept telling myself, you know, you're not going to think about it. You're not going to complain about it. You're just going to keep moving forward. I had met a friend online, Joel, and him and I happened to be the same pace, and we hung out. We tried to make the best of things. We joked about, oh, on top of this hill, there's another hill. Because it's one of those races where you think you might be coming out on the top of the hill, but you look and then there's more hill.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like joke about that. When we knew we were going to miss the cutoff time, we joked and called it like we were doing our own little death march, you know, coming into the finish, and we knew we weren't going to finish. you know, just trying to make the best out of a situation. I think the best part was when we came across Porcupine at night. It was literally the worst part, the most miserable part of the race. And we were both cold and soaked and everything was hurting. And he was having some kind of pain, I think in his leg or something, if I remember. But we came across this porcupine and it was great because it was just so cute.
Uh-huh.
And we could have touched it if we wanted to, but you know, don't touch a porcupine.
Right.
But it just didn't care that we were like right there. So it's like, we took pictures of it. yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So having somebody definitely helped, like, for example, my husband did the 100K race, so he finished. But he didn't have anybody to keep him company like I did. You know, if you can find somebody your pace, and if you're truly, truly suffering, I think that's going to be your number one thing. And Joel and I also told each other, we're like, what's our strategy going to be finishing up this thing? Because I brought up the, you know, dropping out, and I said, I've never dropped out of a race. And he said, I haven't either. And I was like, okay, well, that's going to be our goal. We're going to go until we miss the cutoff time, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, like, was a, big mental strategy as well. It's like, okay, well, we're going to keep going. We're just going to tough this out and just go until we're pulled.
So when did you know that you were going to miss, when did you have the idea that you would miss the cutoff time?
We were coming into, I think the fourth aid station, on our second loop, which we had about 8 or 9 miles, I think, to get back to the school. And I don't remember how much time, but we would be cutting it close. I don't remember what I calculated it out to be, but I think we were maybe 40 minutes past the cutoff time, but also didn't make sense to me because when we were coming back in from the loop, we saw other runners, you know, that were a few miles out going back out. So I don't know, but I know that they pulled the number from our bib, the little tag from our bib saying, "You're done."
Yeah, that's a tough call. I mean, I was there last year, and I it was a different problem. It was excessive heat and similar kind of race. They had 50 people start and I think only 11 finished, but it was just because of the heat. And I made the decision at 35 miles because I just, nobody could move. I mean, everybody was making progress, but the heat, you had to go so slowly. There were a lot of us who kind of looked at this and went, you know, at this point, we're not going to make the cutoff time no matter what. And so, so we had to make that, and that's a hard call. I mean, to decide to end your race.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I would rather somebody else make the decision.
Yeah.
If I can continue on safely, I'm going to.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of an individual thing, because I think people could have continued, but I just with the excessive heat, it was you had the same kind of thing. You were dealing with hypothermia. You have to kind of take your safety into it as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. So what is the difference? I mean, you did your FKTs on your own, and you were here with Joel. And what was kind of the different mental strategy that you had for when you're running by yourself versus when you're running with, when you've got somebody that you can help pull you along?
Yeah, having someone to help pull you along, it's a nice distraction. You got that camaraderie. You're both suffering. Like, oh, he's still going and his leg hurts. Okay, I've got to suck it up and I got to keep going even though my feet hurt. And then when you're out by yourself, you obviously don't have that. So you have to break down. You have to, stick to your mental strategies of, breaking down the course, be like, all right, this, I got to get through this section and then I'll worry about this section and then I'll, do this section. But knowing that, yeah, you're going to eventually be done and you're going to be, feeling pretty good about it when you're done and you can stop running and, stop keeping track of everything. So you're keeping track of so many different things at the same time, like hydration and nutrition. So it's like, yeah, it's going to be a big relief. Just looking forward to being done and having that accomplishment on your belt. And, so that's kind of another mental strategy. Positive self-talk is huge. Having, mindset sort of like cheerleader things you could say to yourself, like what works for you. So for me, it's like, keep going. You're done when you're done. Like, you're doing fine. Like, things like that. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. Those are things I tell myself when I'm out there. And I've also distracted myself with singing songs. I know the one year I did Laurel Highlands and it was night and it was 2020, so we couldn't have pacers, I sang 99 bottles of beer 3 times. That would get me to the aid station. And then, of course, I missed the cutoff time. But, like, so just even if you just sing something, I've sang about, like, in particular, I remember when I did that FKT, I was literally freaking out after I saw the cougar. My body was in, like, it was in shock, and my body was kind of just shutting down. And I had stopped eating and stopped drinking, like, everything, because I was just trying to survive. I started singing to myself because I know that cougars don't like to hear our voices. Mm-hmm. So it kind of helps scare them away at the same time. And I had my whistle, like, by my mouth the whole time, too, just in case. I was singing, like, I hope I see a car soon, or I hope I see somebody come by soon. And, like, all these, like, stupid little things. But it kept me going, and it helped me to feel safe in that highly stressful situation. And I was counting down on my watch. I think that when you get to an, like, near the end of a long effort like that, another thing is just to count down, you know, count down, and even make a song out of that.
That's cool. There's research about the cougar. Talk a little bit, because a lot of people don't go out into the woods by themselves because they're afraid of cougars and Talk a little bit about that research. Where did you read that online about the human voice?
So I was watching a video, I think it was on YouTube, just about wild animals in general, and the man, he might have been like a survivalist or something, but he had, you know, a substantial amount of followers, and he really knew what he was talking about. He went through every single wild animal and talked about, like, when they'll attack, you know, how deadly are they, and what you should do when you, you know, come across this animal out in the woods. And luckily, I remembered watching that and remembered the cougar, and I knew, like, all right, well, he said to act a fool. Act a fool. And, pick up sticks and make yourself look as big as possible. Throw rocks and, you know, things if you have to at it, like if it's going to attack you, like, or if it is attacking you. And don't run, and yell and scream at it as much as possible because they don't like the sound of human voice.
Okay.
So that's where I learned that from. And thank God, because when I came across that cougar, I knew exactly what to do. I didn't run. I screamed at the top of my lungs like I was dying, because I actually thought I was dying. And I did. I blew my whistle at it. And I, you know, I had my lights. I turned music on my phone to try to make extra noise to deter it from, you know, continuing to pursue me. But it was dark. I don't know if it followed me or not, but they're known to stalk people.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of, like, terrifying. I just hiked in the last 3 miles of my run, and it took forever.
Well, especially with you, you know, not knowing, having that feeling, is it? Yeah, what I had heard about the cougar, and it was fairly new to me, was a research study that they did of they hung a radio with just a talk station, I think sports talk or something. They put the radio over a deer that had been killed by a cougar, and then they watched them, and so because the cougars always will come back to their kill. So they don't just get one meal, eat a little bit, then they'll go away and come back. And they saw the cougars come in, and they left because they could hear the voices. And they tested it several other ways as well. But they said, yeah, that the sound of the human voice It was something that the cougars will avoid. So talking to yourself or singing to yourself in the woods is a it was a good thing, at least for cougars anyway.
Right.
Don't know about bears, but no, cougars.
I don't know about bears.
If you are a business owner or an entrepreneur, you know all about stress. Business owners and ultramarathon runners both have to have a strong mindset, but the difference is that business owners and entrepreneurs tend to ignore the warning signs of stress and burnout. When you run an ultramarathon, you push your body to the limit, and you have to manage your energy in an ultramarathon to be successful and make it to the finish line. But when you run an ultramarathon, you get to rest and recover when your race is over. If you're a business owner, you tend to feel like you're in a race with no finish line. In ultramarathon, they call those the last man standing, and the strongest survive. If you're a business owner and you're not careful, you could be one of those who ends up blowing up and not finishing, breaking your body. Business owners tend to keep pushing until something breaks. As a mindset coach, I help business owners manage their energy, de-stress their life, and be profitable as well as healthy and successful. If you are in that situation, contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. That's ultramindsetpodcast.run for a free 25-minute mindset reset. I can help you keep from burning yourself out, managing your energy for success. Well, that's cool. So are you going back to Oil Creek, or do you think that you might try a different 100 mile for?
Yeah, I think what I'm going to do is try a different one. I don't know. Maybe I do a lot better in like the heat. So maybe I'll do a summer 100 miler, but yeah, I'm going to take a break with Oil Creek because, yeah. 3 years. Okay, we'll give it a break and come back another time.
Well, speaking of heat, I think I heard you mention something about Badwater.
Yeah, I wanted to go to Badwater this year so bad to help, you know, like crew and pace people, because I had a few people like reach out, and you know, I knew that there were runners who needed crew members, and I just did not plan to attend, you know, Death Valley this year. I wanted to, and I tried to make it happen since what originally was going on didn't work out. But then it was kind of too late of a notice to try to make it out to Death Valley.
Yeah, I know you crewed somebody out there last year, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I crewed my friend Beth.
Yeah, and so is that something that's on your radar that you think you might? I mean, I know that you say if you do well in the heat, that's one of the hot races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much my A goal. That's my top tier goal, and. Ever since I started ultra running, I learned about ultra running in 2016, and I started doing these races. I've done a lot of things that have just reflected getting myself to that goal. And, I've learned so much, you know, over the journey, and it's truly been life changing.
Yeah. When, and also, I mean, life changing. It's also kind of opened up a career for you as well. You're working as a mindset coach for runners. So tell a little bit. How did you get into to offering that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of just one of those things. So I'm a national certified counselor and licensed professional counselor. I'm kind of like pretty constricted by what I can do, as far as meeting with clients across state lines and, you know, a bunch of other issues with our field that we're trying to work on. But, you know, just I don't want to be restricted with the information and, like, things that I can help people with. So, yeah, I opened up a separate business, Finish Stronger Mindset Coaching, to help reach other people.
Yeah, so because your restrictions are, you can offer mental health services in your state, but you can't do it across state lines.
Right, I can't do it across state lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty silly. Like I'm a national certified counselor, and I specialize in providing telemental health. Like I have a certification, and even with those things, I still can't see people across state lines. It's really silly. Okay.
So you're certified in telemental health, you know, so mm-hmm. doing it remotely, mm-hmm. which is a specific certification.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is that similar? I mean, because you'd be, mental health, I mean, that's in the healthcare industry, would be similar for doctors as well, doctors and, you know, anybody with a medical certification, or is it just for mental health?
No, I would think they have something like that for doctors as well. It's optional, you know, so is being a national certified counselor. Like these are just optional certifications that we can have. So I think that would be something available to doctors as well.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And they might still face the same restrictions with the state medical boards, having different requirements.
Yeah. Yes. So. Yeah.
So yeah, I think a doctor, you'd have to be licensed in every state where you practice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, right. Yeah.
Which makes it kind of difficult if your practice is online, because you really do have, you do have availability to anywhere. So how does your mindset coaching differ from the mental health counseling that you do?
Yeah, so it's non-clinical, and for mindset coaching, so like counseling, let me try to paint a picture. So for counseling, I work with people who struggle with anxiety, trauma, and eating disorders. And I can also work with, athletes as well, because that's what I do,
Mm-hmm.
So I do that for counseling. And then for mindset coaching, I do very similar things. I tell people like I'm knowledgeable, of anxiety, trauma informed. I know about like eating disorders. So if I'm working with somebody, for mindset and they're like struggling in those areas, I'm not going to provide treatment for them, but I can provide them information and I can even help them find somebody, like a therapist to work with them mm-hmm. on the side of what I'm doing with them.
Yeah. It seems that there's would be a little bit of crossover between, but yeah, when you get into actual therapy there, I'm sure there are some therapeutic techniques that you have learned as a therapist that are different than what a mindset coach would provide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that gives me a huge advantage over other mindset coaches, because I do have that counseling background and different strategies than, what other people would use. I do a lot of mindfulness with athletes. I teach them like breathing strategies and, techniques, ways that we can better connect with our body, because whenever we're able to connect with our body, then we can transfer that into running a race and performing at a higher level, giving them mental strategies to like that they can use at home, but also again transfer it over into their racing. So it's kind of like an overall improve your life at home, improve your racing. And I look at everybody as like an individual person. It's not like a medical model or anything. Like I look at, hey, you're like all the different roles that somebody plays. You're a daughter, you're a mom, you've got this job, you've got this going on, you've got that going on. Okay, well, how can we work on these things so that we can also strengthen your you know, your role as an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Better your running again, your performance.
Which is, I mean, I know performance coaches oftentimes will just focus on, I mean, athletic performance coaches will just focus on, you know, the visualization, the strategies for the run, you know, as a runner. And, yeah, because so many times other parts of your life will, you know, they have, you know, your life is, you can't break it up into segments. I mean, you're, the way you process and the way your feelings and emotions all tie into your body all the time. Mm-hmm. So do you notice people that there's people in general often have this disconnect between their body and where their mind is going?
I would say that's something that I think everybody struggles with. And it comes naturally just because our brains are wired to keep us safe and to keep us alive. So if, let's say, somebody who really struggles with anxiety, then they're going to be on like kind of a high alert all the time, and their mind is going to come up with distorted thoughts. This is something I talk with people about. So like distorted thoughts, negative thoughts. Things that, like, our mind will make things that are safe feel kind of unsafe. There's a whole, like, science behind it, which I'm not going to go into it. But, you know, just even knowing this information is helpful for us. But, like I said, our body, our mind is trying to keep us safe. So it's going to kind of hold us back and trip us up.
So it does it interpret the signals? I mean, your body is sending signals. So is it the interpretation of the signals that kind of we get? We don't have a good way to connect with that.
Right. So it's whenever we receive information, it comes in through our eyes, and it has a couple of pathways, and it goes like in through the amygdala, which we have like two of them right here. That's like if you were to intersect from your eyes to, you know, through your ears, where that line would intersect, the amygdala's in there. And that's what processes what we see and keeps us alive. So, for example, if we're driving a car and we, you know, automatically like hit on a brake before we hit a deer, you know, we mm-hmm. step on that brake, that's our amygdala processing. Oh, I need to, like, it's dangerous. I have to step on the brake. But let's say somebody has a fear of driving because of a previous accident that they were in, the amygdala is going to be sort of triggered, you know, processing the information we get from driving our car. So your hands are going to be sweaty. You're going to have probably an elevated heart rate, and you're going to be like looking out for, you know, anything that's going to be an accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be like just, you know, probably really miserable. So that's the amygdala trying to keep you safe again. Like, hey, you were in that accident. I need you to like remember, like, that could happen again. You don't know, that will happen again, you know, and it catastrophizes the thoughts from, you know, your mind will catastrophize and be negative to keep you safe.
Okay. So does that the amygdala then retains those patterns based on the fear? Because I was just, as you were talking, I was thinking, when I was growing up, I was terrified of snakes. In fact, I wouldn't go into the woods because I was so afraid of snakes. And now I'm a trail runner. I can usually tell the difference between a snake and a stick pretty, I mean, I'm aware that they're there, and I don't have that intense fear anymore, but I can usually spot them before anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, our amygdala, it is like that family member, and it nags you over and over again. Like when you see it, it reminds you of that time that something bad happened. So that's like with the snakes, you know, you remember that time from your childhood, and you know, you got on a trail or wherever you associate snakes being, and you're going to be looking for them, you know. You're going to be on high alert, and your amygdala is going to be picking up, wait, sticker snake, and and then that's like, that's how you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I have, you know, it's a fear that I've worked through. I mean, I even had it as an adult for a while, but yeah, it's, I can see them much, very, usually, I mean, and snakes are good at hiding, so it's something that I've, when you were talking about that, I was like, yeah, I can usually see them in the trail, and it's, you know, even if they're fairly well hidden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've picked up that skill over time. And that's another thing I want to say is, like, when it comes to managing anxiety and facing our fears, we can't expect it to just happen right away. It's something that takes years to be able to do, and do it consistently. So as a trail runner, you're out on the trail a lot, and you're in that element a lot, and you come across a lot of snakes. So the more you do that, the more you're showing your amygdala, like, hey, it's okay, I'm out here, I'm doing this, I'm pushing through my fear of coming across a snake, and your amygdala is going to calm down a little bit. And that's what we have to do. We have to stick with that long process to get the amygdala to calm down and not be on that high alert. It's got to be like, okay. And then when you see the snake, it's going to be less of a reaction, mm-hmm, rather than like just completely like freak out.
Well, and I know a lot of trail runners, snakes are a big, you know, that's a big issue for a lot of trail runners. And I have gotten to where I've studied, and, you know, part of my process of trying to get over that was studying to learn about them, what their habits were, you know, what kinds of snakes are out there. And so to be able to identify whether they're poisonous or dangerous or not. They also just like my attention is so that I can avoid them. Not that I'm going to freak out. It's just like I, you know, want to know that they're there so I can stop and go around, or just to leave them alone. So, you know, I kind of enjoy seeing them. It's kind of cool.
That is cool. Yeah, and then you're able to, you know something about them whenever you do see them.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. So it's interesting. You talked about the things that you tell yourself. I was running with a race director helping to clear the flags from a race this last weekend, and we were talking about mindset, and he said he works at the aid station, and he said, here's the speech I give to runners who come into the aid station who want to drop. And he said, you know, you're going to go, you know, you can drop right now, you can go home, and you're going to feel good right away, but when, you know, tomorrow you're going to realize that you quit too soon, and so you're going to spend a whole other year training and all of that time running and putting yourself and run just so you can get to this point 6 miles from the finish line. And next year you're going to feel the same way when you get here. And he said that he tries to help people manage those, you know, manage those kinds of conversations in their head to realize that, hey, you know, I can make it. I can keep going.
Yeah, that's so true. Yep.
Yeah,
that happens a lot.
Well, and it is, I mean, similar to what you say. So do you, I mean, as a mindset coach, do you practice ways to strengthen your mindset to control, to help manage those things in your runs and your races?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it starts outside of racing. You have to, you know, do it at home. I have index cards, and whenever I think of something helpful and I know like it works, that I can tell myself to get myself through something really difficult that I'm going through, I write it down, and then I have, you know, a stack of index cards that, you know, they're there as affirmations that I can get through something, positive self-talk, you know, all of the things that, you know, I can use in life and in my races. And of course, I'm going to also practice them in my training runs. You know, the same as, you know, we practice nutrition and hydration during our training runs, and we have to practice what we say to ourselves mentally as well.
Okay. And I noticed that when you went, all of your affirmations that you say in the third person, does that make a difference?
Yes. Yeah. So research actually shows that it makes a difference. So you don't want to say you can do it. You say, you know, or oh my goodness, I said it wrong. You don't want to say I can do it. You want to say, you know, you can do it. Just like if someone else were talking to you, and if you say it out loud, that makes even more difference, because our brains process hearing our own voice different rather than if it's just coming internally. If you say, like, you can do it outside, like out loud to yourself, you know, when you're on a hard trail run, then your body responds better to it versus internally being like, I can do it.
Okay.
So you can do it.
So, and you said it responds to the voice. So it would be make a difference whether you think, if you were thinking you can do it versus saying you can do it out loud. The out loud even has more influence than just thinking, because I have a tendency to use my internal voice, and I've read about the, you know, the fact of the difference of, you know, saying I can do it, it doesn't have as much power as to say you can do it, if you're you know, as if you were talking to yourself. But I still was doing it as processing, and I didn't talk to myself out loud. So you're saying it out loud actually has more impact.
Mm-hmm. It has more impact. And I found this out a few months ago from my running coach, Kyle Kranz. He said he found a research, and it said that if you add a swear word in there, then it actually improves it even more. So you can effing do it. Like,
so I remember I remember reading that, I mean, like once a long time ago. And so do they know why? Is there a reason why that makes it more effective?
I'm just thinking because like we tend to be more serious if we swear. Just like the impact that word has, you know, we're not just like throwing around a word. Like that's there for a purpose.
Or, I mean, just thinking out loud as you saying that, is it because of the fact that those swear words typically come out in a heightened emotional state? And so do the swear words perhaps trigger like a heightened emotion that would actually give more impact to your hearing of that?
Interesting, quite possibly.
That's because oftentimes, I tend to, and I think we're kind of taught to be intellectual about a lot of life. You know, we process, well, that's supposed to be the higher functions. We're processing things intellectually, and oftentimes our intellect and intellectual processing and our emotional processing kind of have this disconnect. So, you know, if you're intellectually saying you can do it, you can do it. But if you've got the emotion tied to you can do it, you have, I think, maybe have a tendency to make your soul believe that a little bit more strongly than if you were just, if it's just a mental thing or an intellectual thing. So
yeah, having that emotion tied to it makes it stronger.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to learn how to swear better. What about, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on this swear word thing. There are a lot of people who use the F word and, you know, that especially frequently. I mean, like, I spend a lot of time in church, you know, in charismatic churches, and they're, you know, the pastors who use hallelujah and amen the same kind of way. I mean, it's like punctuation, and people swear the same kind of way as preachers use those hallelujahs and amen as just, it's like a mental tick that it just comes out of their mouth. Does that have less impact if those people are using it, you know, I would say overusing it?
I would say yes. Yeah. If it's like an everyday part of your vocabulary, what meaning does that word have? Like, what kind of weight does that carry versus any other word in your vocabulary?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So somebody who swears a lot, sorry, you're out of luck, but if you're if you reserve your swear words for emotional occasions, then let it fly when you're out there on the trail.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think.
That's a good strategy. Well, thank you a lot, Shannon. I appreciate you being here. Before you go, I have a tradition that I started since the last time. I call these the bridge questions. So three questions.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
When you are out there running, what is your must-have piece of gear? And I would say don't count shoes, because it's like most people do. I don't run with shoes, but most people do.
Okay, so I'm going to go with my phone.
Okay.
I struggle to not take pictures if I see something really pretty or really cool, which is like every run.
That's good. That, you know, that there, I've heard that answer from quite a few people, and I get that. So, second question: what is the weirdest thing you've seen when you were out running?
Okay, let's see. So, weirdest thing I actually saw, and it wasn't like a hallucination.
Well, actually, people have counted hallucinations too. So.
I would have to say probably, what is the weirdest thing? Probably like a toolbox and an axe. Yeah, you know, like just randomly out there. Looks like it's been there for a long time. Kind of gave that feeling of like, why is that there, and where's the person who had it, and what were they doing with it,
and why did they leave it?
Yeah.
That definitely would raise some questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the third question is, what word or phrase sums up your philosophy of life?
I'm honestly going to go with what I call my business is it's finish stronger. Finish stronger is kind of like, you know, if I'm having a bad day, what am I going to do to end my day better or stronger than, you know, when I got up this morning and everything started like to seem like it was going wrong. So that's kind of like my philosophy is like, what can I do to like finish stronger to end my day.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I like that. Hey, thank you a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there. More information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. My online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do know somebody who might like it, take just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. you need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.